Welcome to Dangerous Christianity with Dr. Christopher Rodkey, where we explore new ways of being Christian that go against the grain, stands up against the church when it's evil, speaks truth to power, and reclaims the Bible as a radical message of hope, liberation, and justice. Dr. Rodkey is pastor of St. Paul's United Church of Christ in Dallastown, Pennsylvania, and leads the Sacred Profane Community, a post-faith gathering for those seeking to nurture a literate and misfit, geeky, sometimes sneaky, as well as a queer-affirming and beer-affirming spirituality. All information mentioned throughout the program is listed in the show notes. And now, please welcome Dr. Christopher Rodkey.
So we're back doing Mark 3 this week, and I'm going to read from Mark 3 NRSV, beginning with the man with the withered hand. This is continuing the discourse of healing. So I'll read some of this, and then we'll talk about it. So Mark 3, 1, and I'm reading from the NRSV. So again, he, as in Jesus, entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. They watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. And they said to the man who had the withered hand, come forward. Then he said to them, is it lawful to do good or harm on the Sabbath to save life or to kill? But they were silent. He looked around them with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart. He said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out immediately and conspired with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. Verse 7, Jesus departed with his disciples to the sea, and a great multitude from Galilee followed him. Hearing all that he was doing, they came to him in great numbers from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, beyond the Jordan, and the region around Tyre and Sidon. He told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because the crowd said they would not crush him, for he had cured many, so that all who had diseases pressed up upon him to touch him. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and shouted, you are the Son of God, but he sternly ordered them not to make him known. He went up to the mountain and called to him those whom he wanted, and they came to him. And he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, to be with him and to be sent out and proclaim the message and to have the authority to cast out demons. So he appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, son of Zebedee, and John, brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder, and Andrew, Philip, and Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Cananean, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Then he went home, and the crowd came together again so that they could not even eat. When his family heard it, they went out to restrain him, for people were saying, he has gone out of his mind. And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem said, he has Beelzebul, and by the ruler of the demons, he casts out demons. And so he called them to him and spoke to them in parables. How can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And if Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but his end has come. But no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his property without tying up the strong man. Then indeed the house can be plundered. Truly, I tell you, people will be forgiven for their sins, whatever blasphemies they utter, but whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit can never have forgiveness. But is guilty of an eternal sin, for they had said he has an unclean spirit. I'm going to come back to verse 31 if we have time, but there's a lot going on here, and we begin with a continuation of these healing narratives and this discourse on the Sabbath. And I think what's going on here is that there's sort of this sense that the Sabbath is a concept itself is up for discussion. So the Sabbath being the one rule that everyone would follow no matter what, pretty much without exception. They're trying to point at him saying, even the simplest of Jewish mandates you are going against. There were probably some people that worked on the Sabbath that, that probably goes without saying that, you know, somebody was working. But I think, you know, 99.9% of everybody was not. And it's not clear to me from reading around how much like homework, chores around the house and stuff were taken seriously as the Sabbath. But here he is performing a spiritual duty of healing. So faith healers, which would have been hanging around the Galilean region, which we talked about in another week, would have been seen as working, right? This was not a priestly office, right? Now, the priests work on Sunday. It's kind of like when I tell people that I work on Sunday, they're like, well, that's not really work, right? Yeah. And everyone else tells me the only day I work is Sunday. So, you know, is he working as a priest on the Sabbath, or is he working as one of these healers on the Sabbath? Because they weren't seen as the same. And I think that's getting to the heart of this identity that's being worked out in the scripture of who is Jesus, who is this person we're talking about. Going forward, he gathers the multitude by the seaside. The unclean spirits name him the Son of God, which is a political title, as we've talked about before, with the emperor and his father calling themselves sons of God. It's interesting that, again, the demons are naming him an honorific title that would have been what was expected to be named of the emperor, which Jews refused to name, right? So there is this buildup happening here that's not like a real simple thing, that the demons are seeing Jesus as on par with the emperor. But if the demons are calling him the Son of God, it seems to move the one who calls himself the Son of God out of the picture, right? And again, this is not the first time this has happened, that the demons or the spiritual unclean spirits know who Jesus is, and everyone else doesn't seem to. Interestingly, the Pharisees are mentioned here. The Pharisees went out in verse 6. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. The Herodians would have been those who were politically in bed with Herod, or perhaps the servants. I don't think there's a clear sense that the Herodians were a sect of Jews. That might have been a political designation, or they could have just been, could have been a title of what their work was. The Herodians could have even been people like the tax collectors. That's not clear, right? Then we see the multitude gathering by the seaside, and he appoints the 12 disciples. They move him onto a boat so that there's some sense of gap between him and the crowd, so that he can speak to them to keep people away, because so many people were coming. It's an interesting thing to look at here, is whether this was done to keep people away, or because keeping people away was blocking the ministry that he was trying to do. Was this done because he didn't want to deal with them, or because that this became prohibitive to what he wanted to do? And I think that's an interesting question that we don't necessarily need to go into, but that raises the question of some of the intention of what the writer's trying to say here. The famous naming of the apostles, I always think it's funny that, you know, Simon is given the name Peter. We know that Peter's the name Petros, which means rock. It could have been an insult. We don't know that this is like the rock upon which the church is built, although that's what the phrase became. It could have been that he's dumb as a rock, right? It could have been he's heavy as a rock. It could have meant that he is resistant to change, right? He goes down the hill rolling with gravity. You know, any of those metaphors might fit. I know someone that once said that they think it might have had something to do with his bathroom habits. Who knows? But then we get like the sons of thunder, Zebedee, James, son of Zebedee, and John, brother of James, who we call the sons of thunder. Again, we don't really know what that means and why that would be named. That does not come up to my knowledge in later literature. Maybe this is some sort of insult or some kind of like fraternal name, you know, like in, Full House, you know, or not Full House, Animal House, when they're giving the, everybody fraternity names, you know, and he says, I'm going to name you Flipper or whatever. And he says, why Flipper? Why not? Right. So it could say something about the intimacy. It could say something about the nature of the relationship. It might not have been uncommon for the Essenes to give each other honorific names. And so he's taking on this role of being kind of like the abbot, giving new names to his closest companions that would have been honorific names. In the same way that when priests are ordained in the Catholic Church today, they usually take on a second name, you know, that Father Pius is not really named Pius, his name's John. But that might have been the name that he took at his confirmation, which is a practice still done. That if they become ordained, then they take that name as their priest name. Nuns often do the same thing too. That's why they have names like Pius and Aloysius and stuff like that. Their parents didn't give them those names. So it could be saying something about that. It might also be sort of making fun of it too. I think there is a sense of humor underneath here. I'd like to think that Sons of Thunder says something about their flatulence, you know, that they know each other so well that they sort of jab at each other about this. But the honest truth is we don't know what it means. And then this is one of my favorite parts of the Gospels, this bit about Jesus and Beelzebul, which is the very end of verse 19 through 30. And this is a passage of scripture I've kept coming back to over and over again. Because I think it's really telling. And I think this is one of the parts of the Bible that we often read in a very direct way that seemed to be accepted as the way to read it. But I think it's actually saying the opposite of what we often think it said. So if we want to look at this really closely, the crowd comes together again. They're hungry. So his family hears it. Now, this is really interesting because his family is not around him. And a question might be asked by those hearing this for a time, where's his parents at? Like, what's wrong with him? Right? And I also think that there were probably legends of the parents of Jesus, as we've talked about before, of Mary in particular, floating around at this time. This is how they're writing them into the story here, because the family does not appear before this point in Mark. And the family went out to restrain him, saying, you know, people have gone out of your mind. Like, people are saying you're crazy, right? And it got back to them that their son is out there doing crazy stuff. So the rumor even gets to the scribes from Jerusalem. We see them again. And it's clear that these are ones from Jerusalem. So they're ones that are probably reporting to the priests. And they make this declaration, and maybe on the bequest of the family, that's possible, you know, that they asked, you know, the religious leaders to help them out with this because they don't understand it. And so they sent the scribes to figure it out. And they make this pronunciation of he is Beelzebul, and by the ruler of the demons, he casts out demons. So again, this demonic theme comes up again. Now we often think of the Gospel of Mark as the first one written, the one where Jesus is the least divine, or what we might call a low Christology, where that Jesus is not aligned with God in the highest sense, but more everyday, pedestrian, more human. I think it's easy to read Mark that way, that it's probably more historically accurate because it's older. But, you know, we got these demon stories here, right? I mean, we're not in the realm of a philosopher walking around. There's definitely a spiritual warfare going on here. And so the scribes say, he has Beelzebul, right? Now, Beelzebul is a name that I think a lot of people might know as one of the names of the devil. I'm not sure where I became familiar with that, probably from the Bible, but in popular culture, that's a name that's given to the devil. But the talk here is that there is an aspect of the devil that is being invoked here with Beelzebul. And what is Beelzebul? Well, the word itself is a play that suggests that he is Lord of the Flies. Right? He's Lord of the Flies. And specifically, what Pennsylvania Dutch people call the shithouse flies, right? The big flies that you see around the outhouse. And so he has Beelzebul, and by the ruler of the demons, he casts out demons. Now, the context of this is right before this, it's talking about these 12 people following him. So he's Lord of the Flies, and the people who are following him are the flies, right? So he is like the demonic poop, right? To which flies are attracted because that's what flies do, right? That's the implication being made here. That this is bad business, and it attracts people because it's bad business, and it attracts bad people. That's what's being said here, although it is clearly being made in a demonic sense. And then, in response to being told that he's the Lord of the flies, the Lord of he's the demonic poop for which these flies are attracted, he spoke in parables. And we don't really get much of a parable here as we think of as a story, but he says, how can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. Right? If a house is divided against itself, the house will not be able to stand. If Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, for his end has come. No one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his property without first tying up the strong man, and then indeed the house can be plundered. How this is normally read is that, you know, how... if I'm helping people, how is it, why would I be on the side of the demons? Right? If I am out there doing good things, right, and your problem is that I'm doing it on a Sabbath, right? If I'm out there doing good things that are inherently good, how is it that I am on the side of the demons, right? Just because the demons know who I am doesn't mean I'm in cahoots with them. Because a house divided doesn't fall. Like I'm not working against my own self here. That's the typical reading of this, and then by virtue of it, making the claim that those of you who are making these accusations about me are in fact on the side of Satan, right? Because you're standing in the way of the work of God. Now, parables usually indicate a reversal of meaning. So I think that when this was written down, that was what we were intended to hear. That's what the story is saying. But if we look at it a little closely, there's always a reversal, of course, in a parable. And sometimes it's hard to find what that reversal is. And I think what the reversal is here, and this is something I take from a philosopher named René Girard. And I never thought of this before. I read some of his books. Usually every year I pick a theologian or a philosopher and I read all their stuff for about a year, you know, just to learn more. And I think it was 2010, I started reading René Girard because a lot of my friends were into Girard. Reading Girard has changed a lot of my worldview about things. For Girard, this is a key statement in the New Testament, and I think he's right, that it is intentionally set up for us to read it that way, right? And that the pedestrian reading or the surface reading of it is to say, you know, I'm doing the Lord's work. Whose side are you on, right? It's calling them out. But I think there's a deeper sense going on here that's consistent with the use of the word Satan elsewhere in the New Testament, which is that when he asks, does Satan cast out Satan? He doesn't say, no, that isn't how Satan works. He then goes into this parabolic statement. You know, if a kingdom is divided against itself, a kingdom cannot stand, etc. If a house is divided against itself, the house cannot stand. With this, how can Satan cast out Satan? of course, the answer we're kind of baited to say is no, of course Satan doesn't cast out Satan, right? But maybe what is really being said is, of course that's what Satan does. Satan goes in and causes conflict within the house, right? Satan is in there, is that force that seems to be opposing itself or working in cahoots with itself while it eats itself away. And to me, that makes it's not saying something entirely different, but it's saying something much more profound about what's happening here. It's not just implying that, well, if I'm on the side of God, then you're on the side of the devil, because they thought that he was on the side of the devil, right? Anyone that was there, except for the people that were healing them and the disciples, were thinking he was on the side of the devil. They pronounce him to have Beelzebul, right? So if you're saying that I'm the devil and I'm out here doing the Lord's work, whose side are you on, right? I think that is implied here, but I think the deeper meaning here is that you as scribes, you as people who see yourself as part of the mainstream and part of the orthodoxy of this religion, you are the one who is actually dividing the kingdom, right? You're the one who's marginalizing these people. You're the one who's creating the economic situations and the political situations that we find ourselves in, right? You are the problem, right? It isn't that I'm defending myself here, but it's saying something about them in a profound way. And then he goes into, in verse 28, truly I tell you, people will be forgiven for their sins, whatever blasphemies they utter, but whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit can never have forgiveness, but is guilty of an eternal sin, for they had said he has an unclean spirit. So by them saying that he has an unclean spirit, this might not be consistent with Trinitarian doctrine and so forth, but I think what's being said here is, you know, the power of God that's working in him is this Holy Spirit, and you're blaspheming this Holy Spirit. And that's the one thing that cannot be forgiven. You're seeing the work of God in people's lives in a life-changing and healing way, and you're saying that that's demonic, while I'm casting out demons from these people, right? So it emphasizes again, like this sense of this big switcheroo that's happening about whose side is who on. But I think there's something much more deep, and when he calls it blasphemy, while they're calling him a blasphemer, it isn't just saying, well, not me, you're right. It's not this defensive statement, but this profound theological statement that's saying, you aren't just even talking about me, right? When you say these things, you're saying something about God, and there's serious consequences for this, right? Even if I am working on the side of the devil, you're going out there saying that something good that happened to someone is of the devil. So does that imply that someone who's healed is better off with leprosy, right? I mean, what is it you're really saying here, and what exactly is blasphemy when you say it? And I think I said the last time we met that, you know, I love the statement in The Last Temptation of Christ by Nikos Kazantzakis, you know, that I'm the king of blasphemy, right? I mean, it's this sense that if that's what's blasphemy to you, then that's what it is, right? But then the question becomes, what are you, right? And to me, this is the place where the stories of Jesus start unraveling in interesting ways from henceforth, that this is a completely different way of thinking. And again, what I think is brilliant about it from a literary point of view is that I think it's not saying that the surface reading that you read it very quickly is wrong. But if we take the opposite of what we often think it's saying, it's actually saying something consistent with what the other interpretation is saying, but it has far deeper implications that are really condemning. And I think this paves the way for what happens from there. I'm going to stop talking and hear what you have to say. And I'll say a few things about the very end of this where he then engages his family. So I'm going to click mute and hear what you have to say.
I often myself wondered when the scribes and all those other type of people that were the church at the time said things against Jesus, it was always hard for me to determine. Part of what you say is he's the Son of God, but then part of what they say is, I don't know who you think you are, because you're not following our way. So it's hard for me to kind of reconcile those two things that they're saying to Jesus. And I too like this part where he talks about, are you thinking about what you're saying to me here? Because you're saying them to God. And that has consequences. So I can see where you say this then opens up the parables discussions going forward. But that's kind of what I have in my mind when they start testing him about this stuff.
Just so I'm clear about what you're saying is that this is what you're hearing is, you know, who do you, correct me if I'm wrong. Are you hearing Jesus say, who do you think you are? Or do you hear the scribe saying, who do you think you are?
I hear the scribe saying it to Jesus. Mm-hmm. Like, we have these rules, buddy. Like, you're not supposed to be doing stuff on the Sabbath. And here you are out doing stuff on the Sabbath. We caught you.
Well, and I think that's right. I'm not sure that contradicts what I'm trucking at here, but I think that's part of why the Gospel of Mark here in what we've gone through so far so clearly indicates Jesus has the authority to do this. Jesus has the authority over these demons. Jesus, you know, there's a new teaching with authority, you know, in one of the earlier verses that. Where is the authority really, right? The politics and divisions of the Jews of that time under Second Temple Judaism, as we talked about before, with all these different sects that were going around, you know, the question at the heart of it was, what is the role of the temple, right? And how does the temple, which is the primary place of authority in the religion, relate to people that are not living in the city, and more people kind of sprawling out into the countryside, and more Jews living in Hellenistic culture and so on. Like, the future of Judaism did not seem to be in the temple. So it became a crisis of the temple reiterating its authority, but also, as we've talked about before, there were these interesting theological moves that were happening to try to relate the temple to the people in new ways. And still try to establish that authority somehow, even if it was by radicalizing the authority, which is what I think the Pharisees were trying to do. You know, and of course the Essenes were way off in the distance, and the Baptists are way off in the distance, disconnecting themselves. So one way of thinking about Second Temple Judaism is as the so-called temple cult, right? Everything about the religious life revolves around the temple, right? Aside from the temple, there is no Judaism, which is why it was so cataclysmic when the first temple was destroyed, and why it was then so cataclysmic again when the second one was destroyed, because that was the center of everything. Everything had to change, and Judaism from that point forward did change significantly and kind of paved the road for what we know of Judaism today. It's not rabbinic Judaism as it was in ancient times today. So with the authority walking around in Jesus, I think you're right. The authority to which the scribes are referring are the authority of those they're working for, right? And they get their authority because they are from a bloodline of priests or whatever, or the station of the priests in the temple has high authority over everybody. You know, it might not be political authority in the same at that time because of the occupation, but it was theological, spiritual authority. And so then they're encountering Jesus, for whom I think the arguments being set up in early Christianity that Jesus shows us that the temple is not in a building, right? The temple is not on a hill in Jerusalem. The temple is walking around right in front of you, and then later becomes the remnants of God who are left behind after the crucifixion. Right? And of course, what's interesting about that is that, you know, this was pretty much written before the second temple was destroyed, which is why the destruction of the second temple was so important for Christians then, not only because that provided a clear break with Judaism, you know, and put Christianity on a path to sort of repopulate the area that was destroyed, but more directly that, you know, it shows, you know, see, Jesus said that this wasn't what the temple is, right? We don't need this temple, right? We had this temple, it was destroyed, it went away, and then we built something that was shoddy in its place, and then it became a structure that we just sort of worshiped the structure and its structuralism, right? So what Jesus is putting forward here is the sense that the temple, the kingdom of God, is not in the rituals of the temple or in the authority of the temple. It's in you, right? It's in the spirit that's moving through his community that is left over after his disappearance. So it is, Christianity is a temple cult in the sense that it's reversing what it means as temple. So again, I think you're saying it a little different way than I am. I think that's an apt observation that, you know, by whose authority am I speaking here? And Jesus doesn't come out and say, well, I'm the new authority. But everyone else is saying that he's got this authority, right? Are the priests out there commanding the demons, right? Are the priests out there with the people, right? I mean, it's seen as this grassroots authority coming from a far point away, that little by little in the story gets closer and closer to the city where the rabble rousers finally executed, right? I think there is a narrative about the power of the temple that's definitely going on here. And perhaps I read this a little bit through the lens too of, I really, really like William Blake, the poet, and in his writings, there is this reversal that occurs as well that, you know, at the end of the marriage of heaven and hell, you know, it's sort of like a Scooby-Doo episode where the Jesus that the church has been worshiping all along is unmasked by the devil to show that the Jesus they've been following all along has been the devil, right? And the one they thought was the devil all along was really Jesus, right? That it took a complete, you know, Christianity went on this completely different path of missing the point, which is represented in this little pericope here and this little parable that's being told here about Satan casting out Satan. I was always taught that Satan is sort of like this pedophile that's following you around as a child, you know, and is hiding behind the corner and is going to pounce on you at any minute. And I get that that's all metaphor, although I think it was meant to be taken literally when it was taught to us as children. But this suggests that Satan is this inner force within us that's always dividing ourselves, right? It's this point of, it's the very essence of division within a unity that is, you know, makes it very easy to say, well, if I'm doing this, then this can't, you know, talking about me, not Jesus, if I'm doing this, this can't be wrong, when in reality, there's always this force inside of us that's telling us to divide something to reiterate ourselves, right? There is this kind of complex psychology of Satan going on here in the scriptures that I think is much more complex and much more sophisticated than just saying it's the spirit. I do think they think that Satan was this spiritual being. I don't want to make it sound like I don't think that's what they were up to then. But I think it was more than that, in that the Satan is inside of us, right? And it's in everybody. And so these scribes are saying, well, I don't have this Satan, right? And Jesus is saying, well, not so fast, right? We've all got this going on. And the very thing that you're accusing me of, if you take a step back, you'll see that you're not just being a hypocrite, you're saying something really spiritually profound that probably isn't what you really want to say. Is that making some sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And for that reason, I think this is I was really looking forward to talking about this because I think this is just so essential for making sense of this demon language. Because, you know, in mainline churches, we avoid this demon language because this is how people thought about disease back then. Well, it was how they thought about disease, but it was more than that. To suggest that this is just sort of an outmoded way of thinking about medicine isn't entirely false, but it really is a disservice to what's being talked about here. In the same sense that there's this conception of the Gospel of Mark is this low Christology where Jesus is a lot more human than others. I don't think that's the case. I really don't think that's what's going on here. I think it fits a nice narrative about liberal Protestantism to place it that way. And we don't talk about these aspects in the story that do challenge that conception. Because we like to have this low Christology where, you know, you can think of Jesus as being this philosopher going around. But we'll see later that there were a group of philosophers that weren't too different from the early Christians called the Cynics, who are then directly critiqued in the Gospels, you know, and there's a difference, there's a clear difference being placed between the Cynics and the followers of Jesus. And that's in the section where they talk about Jesus giving a dress code to his followers, which makes no sense other than that's what's going on here. It's making a reference to these other philosophers that were walking around that were having a very different dress code and a very different way of living than what the Christ followers did. If I can, if we just look at the last part of this chapter, we have this return to the family, right? So this is 3:31. Then his mother and brothers came, and standing outside, they were sent to him and called him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, "Your mother and your brothers and sisters are outside." Now, there's some translation issues about the sisters here, but your family's outside asking for you. And he said, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And those looking at those who sat around him said, "He said, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother." So again, who are my brother and who are my mother and my brothers? Looking around, who sat around him, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother." I think this is really interesting in that he sort of disses his mother in public, and I think that's. I'm not so sure in the Gospel of Mark that's what is being brought out here, but I think that's part of the larger story that in the end, you know, the mother stays by him after he publicly denounces her or sort of suggests that she's irrelevant, right? And it may be that the way Mark is setting this up here is just Jesus saying, you know, this isn't about my family, right? This is about something completely different. Right. And maybe it isn't so much that he's directing it at his family as it is. It's directed. He's making a philosophical statement or a theological statement about the family and what he means by family, which probably had something to do with how the early church was behaving and thinking of themselves. But the story does follow then that he disses his mother and his mother is the one who sticks by him. I'm not convinced that that's what's really going on here, Mark, but it's part of the story. And I think it's worth bringing out that the mother of Jesus has this special role as this uncredited hero in the story in one way or the other. And this is the first time, again, in chapter 3 is the first time we have a reference to his family. And it's in the reference of dissociating himself. Another possibility is that there were these rumors going around again about his family and being born out of wedlock, and this is his way of sort of distancing himself from that, saying that's not what this is about. This is about something else, and in this new community, in this new kingdom, we are one big family. Deanne, thoughts or questions before I wrap this up? I did a lot of talking again today.
I think it's a... a great example of how difficult it must have been for Mary to have, you know, the Son of God be your kid and try to understand all of these things that he's saying, because she's, you know, just a person like everybody else. So I always wonder what she was thinking. Was she thinking that he was distancing himself from her, or did she automatically go, oh, I know what he's doing? I just wonder that kind of stuff.
Right. And this is actually part of my sermon in church on Sunday morning a couple weeks ago about, you know, when Peter was talking about these elaborate stories that were going around the church about the shortly after this Gospel of Mark was written. You know, I sort of wonder if it was the Christmas stories that were going around that were pointing us backward at the story of Jesus and Mary giving birth as the focus of the faith, rather than looking to the second coming as the focus of the faith, right? We don't know that, though I strongly feel that that's what was going on here. But either way, the virgin birth story is left out of Mark, so that if we're going to identify with Mary in the story, it isn't so much as this divine, somewhat divine mother giving birth. This story that sounds a lot like a Greek myth of Zeus assaulting the pious virgin, but rather, I think a very relatable story for people that, you know, we often don't think about the experience of a mother watching her child be executed by the state. And we can think of that today. And as you know, I worked for a short time in a maximum security prison that had a death row, right? I mean, this is a reality that we have. It's hidden from view. We don't like to show the death penalty and its effects or what it does to families. But this would have been a much more common thing that would have been relatable to everyday women during that time that saw their children being crucified for petty theft or accusations of things. And it wasn't just that they beheaded them. They tortured them and put them on public naked as they were being born. And, you know, does a mother show up and watch that, or is that too painful for a mother to watch, right? And again, I have, maybe it's affected by films and shows that I've seen, but, you know, Mary is always sort of stoic in the presentations watching this, right? And Jesus talks to his mother, right, from the cross. I would assume that it would have been too difficult for most mothers to go through that, and there's Mary sticking with him to the end as part of the someone to relate to in the story. Because again, you know, there's only one Jesus, but executions were done, crucifixions were done daily, right? They claim that they, you know, if you go to the, there's two different places they think the crucifixion happened in Jerusalem. And the one is inside of the big, big church they call the Tomb of the Holy Sepulchre which would have had the ancient wall of the city running through the church. So on one side of it is where the execution happened, the other side is where the resurrection happened, right? Under this huge, huge building, right? And you go there and, you know, there's a space you have to crawl underneath and sort of touch it, is the spot where the cross was, right? There's a good argument to be made that that's where this was based on the geography of what we knew at the time. But there's an entirely possibility that it happened at this other place that has the Tomb of the Resurrection on one side of where the wall would have been. And you can still see sort of the natural barrier of where this would have been later. And there is this huge rock formation there that very much looks like a skull, right? So the place of the skull. Right. It was called the skull because it looked like a skull. And it was the place where, you know, lots and lots and lots of people died. Crucifixion was not something unusual. It was not something that was specially reserved for Jesus here. It was the worst possible way of being executed by an oppressed people. While not that far away in the temple, the spiritual leaders of these people turned their backs on them. Right, and sanctioned it even. interestingly, part of the theory is that the place of the skull, if it in fact did resemble this skull thing, and I took pictures of it, I can show you sometime, because it does sort of look like a skull. One of the theories is that that's where Adam was buried, right, in that spot. Another theory is that when David slayed Goliath, that his head was cut off and brought back to Jerusalem, and the rock formation that's there is what is left of the skull of Goliath, right? And today, at the very top of the hill where the skull, the quote unquote skull, is an Islamic cemetery. And at the bottom of it is a gas station. But you can see the rock formation, and they call it the temple, or the garden, the resurrection garden, I think is what they call it, is this other site that they think the resurrection might've happened. And there's these little tombs. It looks exactly how I sort of picture it. Interestingly, that's one of the few religious spots controlled by Protestants there. Everything else is controlled by various Catholic and Orthodox groups. So it's that's sort of where the Protestants go and think this happened. But it visually looks like what I always thought it was. And one of the things that validates it is this rock formation. So again, this is all to say that for the details of that story sort of line up in a way that women, mothers would have been able to relate to. If they gave birth to girls, they knew that the girls would be second-class citizens. And if they messed up, they could very easily end up as prostitutes or executed on the street. They also, if they gave birth to boys, they knew that if they were really good people, there's a good chance that they might get executed, right? There's going to be, so where does this put the children, the world in which you're giving birth to children in? And I think that's, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's really part of the narrative here as well. Maybe that'd be a good Mother's Day sermon coming down the road.
That'd be great. Thanks so much.
Yep. Thanks, Deanne. And I will see you soon.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Dangerous Christianity. For more information about how to get involved in the movement, how to contact Dr. Christopher Rodkey, or where to find information regarding his preaching itinerary, publications, or how to make a contribution to his ministry, please refer to the listed show notes. Dr. Rodkey again would like to thank all of his listeners for continuously supporting and tuning into his work and message. Thank you.